Parents caught up in this value system were not unkind or even obtuse. They were only preparing their kids for the real world. When these children grew older and applied to college and later for their first jobs, they faced the same standards of gregariousness. University admissions officers looked not for the most exceptional candidates, but for the most extroverted. Harvard's provost, Paul Buck, declared in the late 1940s that Harvard should reject the sensitive, neurotic type and the intellectually overstimulated in favor of boys of the healthy, extrovert kind. In 1950, Yale's president, Alfred Whitney Griswold, declared that the ideal Yalie was not a beetle-browed, highly specialized intellectual, but a well-rounded man. Another dean told White that, in screening applications from secondary schools, he felt it was only common sense to take into account not only what the college wanted, but what, 4 years later, corporations' recruiters would want. "They like a pretty gregarious, active type," he said. "So we find that the best man is the one who's had an 80 or 85 average in school and plenty of extracurricular activity. We see little use for the brilliant introvert." This college dean grasped very well that the model employee of the mid-century, even one whose job rarely involved dealing with the public, like a research scientist in a corporate lab, was not a deep thinker, but a hardy extrovert with a salesman's personality. "Customarily, whenever the word brilliant is used," explains White, "it either precedes the word but, e.g., we are all for brilliance, but, or is coupled with such words as erratic, eccentric, introvert, screwball, etc. These fellows will be having contact with other people in the organization," said one 1950s executive about the hapless scientists in his employ, "and it helps if they make a good impression." The scientist's job was not only to do the research, but also to help sell it, and that required a hail fellow well met demeanor. At IBM, a corporation that embodied the ideal of the company man, the sales force gathered each morning to belt out the company anthem, "Ever Onward," and to harmonize on the "Selling IBM" song, set to the tune of "Singing in the Rain." "Selling IBM," it began, "we're selling IBM. What a glorious feeling. The world is our friend." The ditty built to a stirring close. "We're always in trim. We work with a vim. We're selling, just selling, IBM." Then they went off to pay their sales calls, proving that the admissions people at Harvard and Yale were probably right. Only a certain type of fellow could possibly have been interested in kicking off his mornings this way. The rest of the organization men would have to manage as best they could. And if the history of pharmaceutical consumption is any indication, many buckled under such pressures. In 1955, a drug company named Carter Wallace released the anti-anxiety drug Miltown, reframing anxiety as the natural product of a society that was both dog-eat-dog and relentlessly social. Miltown was marketed to men and immediately became the fastest-selling pharmaceutical in American history, according to the social historian Andrea Tone. By 1956, one of every 20 Americans had tried it. By 1960, a third of all prescriptions from U.S. doctors were for Miltown, or a similar drug called Equinil. "Anxiety and tension are the commonplace of the age," read the Equinil ad. The 1960s tranquilizer Sorrentil followed with an ad campaign even more direct in its appeal to improve social performance. "For the anxiety that comes from not fitting in," it empathized. Of course, the extrovert ideal is not a modern invention. Extroversion is in our DNA, literally, according to some psychologists. The trait has been found to be less prevalent in Asia and Africa than in Europe and America, whose populations descend largely from the migrants of the world. It makes sense, say these researchers, that world travelers were more extroverted than those who stayed home, and that they passed on their traits to their children and their children's children. "As personality traits are genetically transmitted," writes the psychologist Kenneth Olson, "each succeeding wave of emigrants to a new continent would give rise over time to a population of more engaged individuals than reside in the emigrant's continent of origin. We can also trace our admiration of extroverts to the Greeks, for whom oratory was an exalted skill, and to the Romans, for whom the worst possible punishment was banishment from the city, with its teeming social life. Similarly, we revere our founding fathers precisely because they were loudmouths on the subject of freedom. Give me liberty or give me death. Even the Christianity of early American religious revivals, dating back to the first Great Awakening of the 18th century, depended on the showmanship of ministers who were considered successful if they caused crowds of normally reserved people to weep and shout and generally lose their decorum. Nothing gives me more pain and distress than to see a minister standing almost motionless, coldly plodding on as a mathematician would calculate the distance of the moon from the earth, complained a religious newspaper in 1837. As this disdain suggests, early Americans revered action and were suspicious of intellect, associating the life of the mind with the languid, ineffectual European aristocracy they had left behind. The 1828 presidential campaign pitted a former Harvard professor, John Quincy Adams, against Andrew Jackson, a forceful military hero. A Jackson campaign slogan tellingly distinguished the two: John Quincy Adams, who can write, and Andrew Jackson, who can fight. The victor of that campaign? The fighter beat the writer, as the cultural historian Neil Gabler puts it. John Quincy Adams, incidentally, is considered by political psychologists to be one of the few introverts in presidential history. But the rise of the culture of personality intensified such biases and applied them not only to political and religious leaders, but also to regular people. And though soap manufacturers may have profited from the new emphasis on charm and charisma, not everyone was pleased with this development. Respect for individual human personality has with us reached its lowest point, observed one intellectual in 1921, and it is delightfully ironical that no nation is so constantly talking about personality as we are. We actually have schools for self-expression and self-development, although we seem usually to mean the expression and development of the personality of a successful real estate agent. Another critic bemoaned the slavish attention Americans were starting to pay to entertainers. It is remarkable how much attention the stage and things pertaining to it are receiving nowadays from the magazines, he grumbled. Only 20 years earlier, during the culture of character, that is, such topics would have been considered indecorous. Now they had become such a large part of the life of society that it has become a topic of conversation among all classes. Even T.S. Eliot's famous 1915 poem, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, in which he laments the need to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet, seems a cri de coeur about the new demands of self-presentation. While poets of the previous century had wandered lonely as a cloud through the countryside, Wordsworth in 1802, or repaired in solitude to Walden Pond, Thoreau in 1845, Eliot's Prufrock mostly worries about being looked at by eyes that fix you in a formulated phrase and pin you, wriggling, to a wall. Fast forward nearly 100 years, and Prufrock's protest is enshrined in high school syllabi, where it's dutifully memorized, then quickly forgotten, by teens increasingly skilled at shaping their own online and offline personae. These students inhabit a world in which status, income, and self-esteem depend more than ever on the ability to meet the demands of the culture of personality. The pressure to entertain, to sell ourselves, and never to be visibly anxious keeps ratcheting up. The number of Americans who considered themselves shy increased from 40% in the 1970s to 50% in the 1990s, probably because we measured ourselves against ever higher standards of fearless self-presentation. Social anxiety disorder, which essentially means pathological shyness, is now thought to afflict nearly 1 in 5 of us. The most recent version of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM-IV, the psychiatrist's Bible of Mental Disorders, considers the fear of public speaking to be a pathology, not an annoyance, not a disadvantage, but a disease, if it interferes with the sufferer's job performance. It's not enough, one senior manager at Eastman Kodak told the author Daniel Goleman, to be able to sit at your computer excited about a fantastic regression analysis if you're squeamish about presenting those results to an executive group. Apparently, it's okay to be squeamish about doing a regression analysis if you're excited about giving speeches. But perhaps the best way to take the measure of the 21st century culture of personality is to return to the self-help arena. Today, a full century after Dale Carnegie launched that first public speaking workshop at the YMCA, his best-selling book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, is a staple of airport bookshelves and business bestseller lists. The Dale Carnegie Institute still offers updated versions of Carnegie's original classes, and the ability to communicate fluidly remains a core feature of the curriculum. Toastmasters, the nonprofit organization established in 1924, whose members meet weekly to practice public speaking, and whose founder declared that all talking is selling and all selling involves talking, is still thriving, with more than 12,500 chapters in 113 countries. The promotional video on Toastmasters' website features a skit in which two colleagues, Eduardo and Sheila, sit in the audience at the 6th annual Global Business Conference as a nervous speaker stumbles through a pitiful presentation. "I'm so glad I'm not him," whispers Eduardo. "You're joking, right?" replies Sheila with a satisfied smile. "Don't you remember last month's sales presentation to those new clients? I thought you were going to faint." "I wasn't that bad, was I?" "Oh, you were that bad. Really bad. Worse, even." Eduardo looks suitably ashamed, while the rather insensitive Sheila seems oblivious. "But," says Sheila, "you can fix it. You can do better. Have you ever heard of Toastmasters?" Sheila, a young and attractive brunette, hauls Eduardo to a Toastmasters meeting. There she volunteers to perform an exercise called Truth or Lie, in which she's supposed to tell the group of 15-odd participants a story about her life, after which they decide whether or not to believe her. "I bet I can fool everyone," she whispers to Eduardo sotto voce as she marches to the podium. She spins an elaborate tale about her years as an opera singer, concluding with her poignant decision to give it all up to spend more time with her family. When she's finished, the toastmaster of the evening asks the group whether they believe Sheila's story. All hands in the room go up. The toastmaster turns to Sheila and asks whether it was true. "I can't even carry a tune," she beams triumphantly. Sheila comes across as disingenuous, but also oddly sympathetic. Like the anxious readers of the 1920s personality guides, she's only trying to get ahead at the office. "There's so much competition in my work environment," she confides to the camera, "that it makes it more important than ever to keep my skills sharp." But what do sharp skills look like? Should we become so proficient at self-presentation that we can dissemble without anyone suspecting? Must we learn to stage manage our voices, gestures, and body language until we can tell, sell, any story we want? These seem venal aspirations, a marker of how far we've come, and not in a good way, since the days of Dale Carnegie's childhood. Dale's parents had high moral standards. They wanted their son to pursue a career in religion or education, not sales. It seems unlikely that they would have approved of a self-improvement technique called Truth or Lie, or for that matter, of Carnegie's best-selling advice on how to get people to admire you and do your bidding. How to Win Friends and Influence People is full of chapter titles like Making People Glad to Do What You Want and How to Make People Like You Instantly, all of which raises the question, how did we go from character to personality without realizing that we had sacrificed something meaningful along the way? Chapter 2. The Myth of Charismatic Leadership, The Culture of Personality, 100 Years Later. Society is itself an education in the extrovert values, And rarely has there been a society that has preached them so hard. No man is an island. But how John Donne would writhe to hear how often, and for what reasons, the thought is so tiresomely repeated. William White. Salesmanship as a Virtue. Live with Tony Robbins. "Are you excited?" cries a young woman named Stacy as I hand her my registration forms. Her honeyed voice rises into one big exclamation point. I nod and smile as brightly as I can. Across the lobby of the Atlanta Convention Center, I hear people shrieking. "What's that noise?" I ask. "They're getting everyone pumped up to go inside," Stacy enthuses. "That's part of the whole UPW experience." She hands me a purple spiral binder and a laminated name tag to wear around my neck. "Unleash the power within," proclaims the binder in big block letters. "Welcome to Tony Robbins' entry-level seminar. I've paid $895 in exchange, according to the promotional materials, for learning how to be more energetic, gain momentum in my life, and conquer my fears. But the truth is that I'm not here to unleash the power within me, though I'm always happy to pick up a few pointers. I'm here because this seminar is the first stop on my journey to understand the extrovert ideal. I've seen Tony Robbins's infomercials. He claims that there's always one airing at any given moment, and he strikes me as one of the more extroverted people on earth. But he's not just any extrovert. He's the king of self-help, with a client roster that has included President Clinton, Tiger Woods, Nelson Mandela, Margaret Thatcher, Princess Diana, Mikhail Gorbachev, Mother Teresa, Serena Williams, Donna Karen, and 50 million other people. And the self-help industry, into which hundreds of thousands of Americans pour their hearts, souls, and some $11 billion a year, by definition reveals our conception of the ideal self, the one we aspire to become, if only we follow the 7 principles of this and the 3 laws of that. I want to know what this ideal self looks like. Stacy asks if I brought my meals with me. It seems a strange question. Who carries supper with them from New York City to Atlanta? She explains that I'll want to refuel at my seat. For the next 4 days, Friday through Monday, we'll be working 15 hours a day, 8 a.m. to 11 p.m., with only one short afternoon break. Tony will be on stage the entire time, and I won't want to miss a moment. I look around the lobby. Other people seem to have come prepared. They're strolling toward the hall, cheerfully lugging grocery bags stuffed with power bars, bananas, and corn chips. I pick up a couple of bruised apples from the snack bar and make my way to the auditorium. Greeters, wearing UPW t-shirts and ecstatic smiles, line the entrance, springing up and down, fists pumping. You can't get inside without slapping them 5. I know, because I try. Inside the vast hall, a phalanx of dancers is warming up the crowd to the Billy Idol song Money Money, amplified by a world-class sound system, magnified on giant Megatron screens flanking the stage. They move in sync like backup dancers in a Britney Spears video, but are dressed like middle managers. The lead performer is a 40-something balding fellow, wearing a white button-down shirt, conservative tie, rolled-up sleeves, and a great-to-meet-you smile. The message seems to be that we can all learn to be this exuberant when we get to work every morning. Indeed, the dance moves are simple enough for us to imitate at our seats. Jump and clap twice, clap to the left, clap to the right. When the song changes to Gimme Some Lovin', many in the audience climb atop their metal folding chairs, where they continue to whoop and clap. I stand somewhat peevishly with arms crossed until I decide that there's nothing to be done but join in and hop up and down along with my seatmates. Eventually, the moment we've all been waiting for arrives. Tony Robbins bounds on stage. Already gigantic at 6'7", he looks 100 feet tall on the Megatron screen. He's movie star handsome, with a head of thick brown hair, a pepsodent smile, and impossibly defined cheekbones. "Experience Tony Robbins live," the seminar advertisement had promised, and now here he is, dancing with the euphoric crowd. It's about 50 degrees in the hall, but Tony is wearing a short-sleeved polo shirt and shorts. Many in the audience have brought blankets with them, having somehow known that the auditorium would be kept refrigerator cold, presumably to accommodate Tony's high-octane metabolism. It would take another ice age to cool this man off. He's leaping and beaming and managing somehow to make eye contact with all 3,800 of us. The greeters jump rapturously in the aisles. Tony opens his arms wide, embracing us all. If Jesus returned to Earth and made his first stop at the Atlanta Convention Center, it would be hard to imagine a more jubilant reception. This is true even in the back row, where I'm sitting with others who spent only $895 for general admission, as opposed to $2,500 for a Diamond Premier membership, which gets you a seat up front, as close to Tony as possible. When I bought my ticket over the phone, the account rep advised me that the people in the front rows, where you're looking directly at Tony for sure, instead of relying on the Megatron, are generally more successful in life. Those are the people who have more energy, she advised. Those are the people who are screaming. I have no way of judging how successful the people next to me are, but they certainly seem thrilled to be here. At the sight of Tony, exquisitely stage-lit to set off his expressive face, they cry out and pour into the aisles rock concert style. Soon enough, I join them. I've always loved to dance, and I have to admit that gyrating en masse to Top 40 classics is an excellent way to pass the time. Unleashed power comes from high energy, according to Tony, and I can see his point. No wonder people travel from far and wide to see him in person. There's a lovely young woman from Ukraine sitting, no, leaping, next to me with a delighted smile. I really must start doing aerobics again when I get back to New York, I decide. When the music finally stops, Tony addresses us in a raspy voice, half Muppet, half bedroom sexy, introducing his theory of practical psychology. The gist of it is that knowledge is useless unless it's coupled with action. He has a seductive, fast-talking delivery that Willie Loman would have sighed over. Demonstrating practical psychology in action, Tony instructs us to find a partner and to greet each other as if we feel inferior and scared of social rejection. I team up with a construction worker from downtown Atlanta, and we extend tentative handshakes, looking bashfully at the ground as the song "I Want You to Want Me" plays in the background. Then Tony calls out a series of artfully phrased questions. Was your breath full or shallow? Shallow, yells the audience in unison. Did you hesitate or go straight toward them? Hesitate. Was there tension in your body or were you relaxed? Tension. Tony asks us to repeat the exercise, but this time to greet our partners as if the impression we make in the first 3 to 5 seconds determines whether they'll do business with us. If they don't, everyone you care about will die like pigs in hell. I'm startled by Tony's emphasis on business success. This is a seminar about personal power, not sales. Then I remember that Tony is not only a life coach, but also a businessman extraordinaire. He started his career in sales and today serves as chairman of 7 privately held companies. Business Week once estimated his income at $80 million a year. Now he seems to be trying, with all the force of his mighty personality, to impart his salesman's touch. He wants us not only to feel great, but to radiate waves of energy, not just to be liked, but to be well-liked. He wants us to know how to sell ourselves. I've already been advised by the Anthony Robbins companies via a personalized 45-page report generated by an online personality test that I took in preparation for this weekend that Susan should work on her tendency to tell, not sell, her ideas. The report was written in the third person, as if it was to be reviewed by some imaginary manager evaluating my people skills. The audience divides into pairs again, enthusiastically introducing themselves and pumping their partner's hands. When we're finished, the questions repeat. Did that feel better? Yes or no? Yes. Did you use your body differently? Yes or no? Yes. Did you use more muscles in your face? Yes or no? Yes. Did you move straight toward them? Yes or no? Yes. This exercise seems designed to show how our physiological state influences our behavior and emotions, but it also suggests that salesmanship governs even the most neutral interactions. It implies that every encounter is a high-stakes game in which we win or lose the other person's favor. It urges us to meet social fear in as extroverted a manner as possible. We must be vibrant and confident. We must not seem hesitant. We must smile so that our interlocutors will smile upon us. Taking these steps will make us feel good. And the better we feel, the better we can sell ourselves. Tony seems the perfect person to demonstrate such skills. He strikes me as having a hyperthymic temperament, a kind of extroversion on steroids, characterized, in the words of one psychiatrist, by exuberant, upbeat, over-energetic, and overconfident lifelong traits that have been recognized as an asset in business, especially sales. People with these traits often make wonderful company, as Tony does on stage. But what if you admire the hyperthymic among us, but also like your calm and thoughtful self? What if you love knowledge for its own sake, not necessarily as a blueprint to action? What if you wish there were more, not fewer, reflective types in the world? Tony seems to have anticipated such questions. "But I'm not an extrovert, you say," he told us at the start of the seminar. "So, you don't have to be an extrovert to feel alive." True enough. But it seems, according to Tony, that you'd better act like one if you don't want to flub the sales call and watch your family die like pigs in hell. The evening culminates with the firewalk, one of the flagship moments of the UPW seminar, in which we're challenged to walk across a 10-foot bed of coals without burning our feet. Many people attend UPW because they've heard about the firewalk and want to try it themselves. The idea is to propel yourself into such a fearless state of mind that you can withstand even 1,200-degree heat. Leading up to that moment, we spend hours practicing Tony's techniques, exercises, dance moves, visualizations. I notice that people in the audience are starting to mimic Tony's every movement and facial expression, including his signature gesture of pumping his arm as if he were pitching a baseball. The evening crescendos until finally, just before midnight, we march to the parking lot in a torch-lit procession, nearly 4,000 strong, chanting, "Yes, yes, yes," to the thump of a tribal beat. This seems to electrify my fellow UPWers. But to me, this drum-accompanied chant, "Yes, ba-da-da-da, yes, dum-dum-dum-dum, yes, ba-da-da-da," sounds like the sort of thing a Roman general would stage to announce his arrival in the city he's about to sack. The greeters who manned the gates to the auditorium earlier in the day with high fives and bright smiles have morphed into gatekeepers of the firewalk, arms beckoning toward the bridge of flames. As best I can tell, a successful firewalk depends not so much on your state of mind as on how thick the soles of your feet happen to be, so I watch from a safe distance. But I seem to be the only one hanging back. Most of the UPWers make it across, whooping as they go. "I did it," they cry when they get to the other side of the fire pit. "I did it." They've entered a Tony Robbins state of mind. But what exactly does this consist of? It is, first and foremost, a superior mind, the antidote to Alfred Adler's inferiority complex. Tony uses the word power rather than superior. We're too sophisticated nowadays to frame our quests for self-improvement in terms of naked social positioning, the way we did at the dawn of the culture of personality. But everything about him is an exercise in superiority, from the way he occasionally addresses the audience as girls and boys, to the stories he tells about his big houses and powerful friends, to the way he towers literally over the crowd. His superhuman physical size is an important part of his brand. The title of his best-selling book, Awaken the Giant Within, says it all. His intellect is impressive, too. Though he believes university educations are overrated because they don't teach you about your emotions and your body, he says, and has been slow to write his next book because no one reads anymore, according to Tony, He's managed to assimilate the work of academic psychologists and package it into one hell of a show, with genuine insights the audience can make their own. Part of Tony's genius lies in the unstated promise that he'll let the audience share his own journey from inferiority to superiority. He wasn't always so grand, he tells us. As a kid, he was a shrimp. Before he got in shape, he was overweight. And before he lived in a castle in Del Mar, California, he rented an apartment so small that he kept his dishes in the bathtub. The implication is that we can all get over whatever's keeping us down, that even introverts can learn to walk on coals while belting out a lusty yes. The second part of the Tony state of mind is good-heartedness. He wouldn't inspire so many people if he didn't make them feel that he truly cared about unleashing the power within each of them. When Tony's on stage, you get the sense that he's singing, dancing, and emoting with every ounce of his energy and heart. There are moments when the crowd is on its feet, singing and dancing in unison, that you can't help but love him, the way many people loved Barack Obama, with a kind of shocked delight when they first heard him talk about transcending red and blue. At one point, Tony talks about the different needs people have for love, certainty, variety, and so on. He is motivated by love, he tells us, and we believe him. But there's also this. Throughout the seminar, he constantly tries to upsell us. He and his sales team use the UPW event, whose attendees have already paid a goodly sum, to market multi-day seminars with even more alluring names and stiffer price tags. Date with Destiny, about $5,000. Mastery University, about $10,000. And the Platinum Partnership, which, for a cool $45,000 a year, buys you and 11 other Platinum partners the right to go on exotic vacations with Tony. During the afternoon break, Tony lingers on stage with his blonde and sweetly beautiful wife, Sage, gazing into her eyes, caressing her hair, murmuring into her ear. I'm happily married, but right now Ken is in New York, and I'm here in Atlanta, and even I feel lonely as I watch this spectacle. What would it be like if I were single or unhappily partnered? It would arouse an eager want in me, just as Dale Carnegie advised salesmen to do with their prospects so many years ago. And sure enough, when the break is over, a lengthy video comes on the mega screen, pitching Tony's relationship-building seminar. In another brilliantly conceived segment, Tony devotes part of the seminar to explaining the financial and emotional benefits of surrounding oneself with the right peer group, after which a staffer begins a sales pitch for the $45,000 Platinum program. Those who purchase one of the 12 spots will join the ultimate peer group, we are told, the cream of the crop, the elite of the elite of the elite. I can't help but wonder why none of the other UPWers seem to mind or even to notice these upselling techniques. By now, many of them have shopping bags at their feet, full of stuff they bought out in the lobby, DVDs, books, even 8x10 glossies of Tony himself, ready for framing. But the thing about Tony, and what draws people to buy his products, is that like any good salesman, he believes in what he's pitching. He apparently sees no contradiction between wanting the best for people and wanting to live in a mansion. He persuades us that he's using his sales skills not only for personal gain, but also to help as many of us as he can reach. Indeed, one very thoughtful introvert I know, a successful salesman who gives sales training seminars of his own, swears that Tony Robbins not only improved his business, but also made him a better person. When he started attending events like UPW, he says, he focused on who he wanted to become, and now, when he delivers his own seminars, he is that person. Tony gives me energy, he says, and now I can create energy for other people when I'm on stage. At the onset of the culture of personality, we were urged to develop an extroverted personality for frankly selfish reasons, as a way of outshining the crowd in a newly anonymous and competitive society. But nowadays, We tend to think that becoming more extroverted not only makes us more successful, but also makes us better people. We see salesmanship as a way of sharing one's gifts with the world. This is why Tony's zeal to sell to and be adulated by thousands of people at once is seen not as narcissism or hucksterism, but as leadership of the highest order. If Abraham Lincoln was the embodiment of virtue during the culture of character, then Tony Robbins is his counterpart during the culture of personality. Indeed, when Tony mentions that he once thought of running for President of the United States, the audience erupts in loud cheers. But does it always make sense to equate leadership with hyper-extroversion? To find out, I visited Harvard Business School, an institution that prides itself on its ability to identify and train some of the most prominent business and political leaders of our time. The Myth of Charismatic Leadership, Harvard Business School and Beyond. The first thing I notice about the Harvard Business School campus is the way people walk. No one ambles, strolls, or lingers. They stride, full of forward momentum. It's crisp and autumnal the week I visit, and the students' bodies seem to vibrate with September electricity as they advance across campus. When they cross each other's paths, they don't merely nod. They exchange animated greetings, inquiring about this one's summer with J.P. Morgan or that one's trek in the Himalayas. They behave the same way inside the social hothouse of the Spangler Center, the sumptuously decorated student center. Spangler has floor-to-ceiling silk curtains in seafoam green, rich leather sofas, giant Samsung high-definition TVs silently broadcasting campus news, and soaring ceilings festooned with high-wattage chandeliers. The tables and sofas are clustered mostly on the perimeter of the room, forming a brightly lit center catwalk down which the students breezily parade, seemingly unaware that all eyes are on them. I admire their nonchalance. The students are even better turned out than their surroundings, if such a thing is possible. No one is more than 5 pounds overweight, or has bad skin, or wears odd accessories. The women are a cross between head cheerleader and most likely to succeed. They wear fitted jeans, filmy blouses, and high-heeled peekaboo-toed shoes that make a pleasant clickety-clack on Spangler's polished wood floors. Some parade like fashion models, except that they're social and beaming instead of aloof and impassive. The men are clean-cut and athletic. They look like people who expect to be in charge, but in a friendly, Eagle Scout sort of way. I have the feeling that if you asked one of them for driving directions, he'd greet you with a can-do smile and throw himself into the task of helping you to your destination, whether or not he knew the way. I sit down next to a couple of students who are in the middle of planning a road trip. HBS students are forever coordinating pub crawls and parties or describing an extreme travel junket they've just come back from. When they ask what brings me to campus, I say that I'm conducting interviews for a book about introversion and extroversion. I don't tell them that a friend of mine, himself an HBS grad, once called the place the spiritual capital of extroversion. But it turns out that I don't have to tell them. "Good luck finding an introvert around here," says one. "This school is predicated on extroversion," adds the other. "Your grades and social status depend on it. It's just the norm here. Everyone around you is speaking up and being social and going out." "Isn't there anyone on the quieter side?" I ask. They look at me curiously. "I couldn't tell you," says the first student dismissively. Harvard Business School is not, by any measure, an ordinary place. Founded in 1908, just when Dale Carnegie hit the road as a traveling salesman, and only 3 years before he taught his first class in public speaking, the school sees itself as educating leaders who make a difference in the world. President George W. Bush is a graduate, as are an impressive collection of World Bank presidents, U.S. Treasury secretaries, New York City mayors, CEOs of companies like General Electric, Goldman Sachs, Procter & Gamble, and more notoriously, Jeffrey Skilling, the villain of the Enron scandal. Between 2004 and 2006, 20% of the top three executives at the Fortune 500 companies were HBS grads. HBS grads likely have influenced your life in ways you're not aware of, They have decided who should go to war and when. They have resolved the fate of Detroit's auto industry. They play leading roles in just about every crisis to shake Wall Street, Main Street, and Pennsylvania Avenue. If you work in corporate America, there's a good chance that Harvard Business School grads have shaped your everyday life, too, weighing in on how much privacy you need in your workspace, how many team-building sessions you need to attend per year, and whether creativity is best achieved through brainstorming or solitude. Given the scope of their influence, it's worth taking a look at who enrolls here and what they value by the time they graduate. The student who wishes me luck in finding an introvert at HBS no doubt believes that there are none to be found. But clearly, he doesn't know his first-year classmate, Don Chen. I first meet Don in Spangler, where he's seated only a few couches away from the road trip planners. He comes across as a typical HBS student, tall, with gracious manners, prominent cheekbones, a winsome smile, and a fashionably choppy surfer-dude haircut. He'd like to find a job in private equity when he graduates. But talk to Don for a while, and you'll notice that his voice is softer than those of his classmates, his head ever so slightly cocked, his grin a little tentative. Don is a bitter introvert, as he cheerfully puts it. Bitter because the more time he spends at HBS, the more convinced he becomes that he'd better change his ways. Don likes having a lot of time to himself, but that's not much of an option at HBS. His day begins early in the morning, when he meets for an hour and a half with his learning team, a pre-assigned study group in which participation is mandatory. Students at HBS practically go to the bathroom in teams. He spends the rest of the morning in class, where 90 students sit together in a wood-paneled, U-shaped amphitheater with stadium seating. The professor usually kicks off by directing a student to describe the case study of the day, which is based on a real-life business scenario, say, a CEO who's considering changing her company's salary structure. The figure at the heart of the case study, in this case the CEO, is referred to as the protagonist. If you were the protagonist, the professor asks, and soon you will be, is the implication, what would you do? The essence of the HBS education is that leaders have to act confidently and make decisions in the face of incomplete information. The teaching method plays with an age-old question. If you don't have all the facts, and often you won't, should you wait to act until you've collected as much data as possible? Or, by hesitating, do you risk losing others' trust and your own momentum? The answer isn't obvious. If you speak firmly on the basis of bad information, you can lead your people into disaster. But if you exude uncertainty, then morale suffers, funders won't invest, and your organization can collapse. The HBS teaching method implicitly comes down on the side of certainty. The CEO may not know the best way forward, but she has to act anyway. The HBS students, in turn, are expected to opine. Ideally, the student who is just cold-called has already discussed the case study with his learning team, so he's ready to hold forth on the protagonist's best moves. After he finishes, the professor encourages other students to offer their own views. Half of the student's grade, and a much larger percentage of their social status, is based on whether they throw themselves into this fray. If a student talks often and forcefully, then he's a player. If he doesn't, he's on the margins. Many of the students adapt easily to this system, but not Don. He has trouble elbowing his way into class discussions. In some classes, he barely speaks at all. He prefers to contribute only when he believes he has something insightful to add, or honest to God disagrees with someone. This sounds reasonable, but Don feels as if he should be more comfortable talking, just so he can fill up his share of available airtime. Don's HBS friends, who tend to be thoughtful, reflective types like him, spend a lot of time talking about talking in class. How much class participation is too much? How little is too little? When does publicly disagreeing with a classmate constitute healthy debate? And when does it seem competitive and judgmental? One of Don's friends is worried because her professor sent around an email saying that anyone with real-world experience on the day's case study should let him know in advance. She's sure that the professor's announcement was an effort to limit stupid remarks like the one she made in class last week. Another worries that he's not loud enough. "I just have a naturally soft voice," he says, "so when my voice sounds normal to others, I feel like I'm shouting. I have to work on it." The school also tries hard to turn quiet students into talkers. The professors have their own learning teams, in which they egg each other on with techniques to draw out reticent students. When students fail to speak up in class, it's seen not only as their own deficit, but also as their professor's. If someone doesn't speak by the end of the semester, it's problematic. Professor Michelle Antaby told me, "It means I didn't do a good job." The school even hosts live informational sessions and web pages on how to be a good class participator. Don's friends earnestly reel off the tips they remember best. Speak with conviction, even if you believe something only 55%. Say it as if you believe it 100%. If you're preparing alone for class, then you're doing it wrong. Nothing at HBS is intended to be done alone. Don't think about the perfect answer. It's better to get out there and say something than to never get your voice in. The school newspaper, The Harbus, also dispenses advice, featuring articles with titles like "How to Think and Speak Well on the Spot," "Developing Your Stage Presence," and "Arrogant or Simply Confident." These imperatives extend beyond the classroom. After class, most people eat lunch at the Spangler Dining Hall, which one grad describes as more like high school than high school. And every day, Don wrestles with himself. Should he go back to his apartment and recharge over a quiet lunch, as he longs to do, or join his classmates? Even if he forces himself to go to Spangler, it's not as if the social pressure will end there. As the day wears on, there will be more such dilemmas. Attend the late afternoon happy hours? Head out for a late, rowdy evening? Students at HBS go out in big groups several nights a week, says Don. Participation isn't mandatory, but it feels as if it is to those who don't thrive on group activities. Socializing here is an extreme sport, one of Don's friends tells me. People go out all the time. If you don't go out one night, the next day people will ask, "Where were you?" I go out at night like it's my job. Don has noticed that the people who organize social events, happy hours, dinners, drinking fests, are at the top of the social hierarchy. "The professors tell us that our classmates are the people who will go to our weddings," says Don. "If you leave HBS without having built an extensive social network, it's like you failed your HBS experience." By the time Don falls into bed at night, he's exhausted. And sometimes he wonders why exactly he should have to work so hard at being outgoing. Don is Chinese-American, and recently he worked a summer job in China. He was struck by how different the social norms were and how much more comfortable he felt. In China, there was more emphasis on listening, on asking questions rather than holding forth, on putting others' needs first. In the United States, he feels, conversation is about how effective you are at turning your experiences into stories. Whereas a Chinese person might be concerned with taking up too much of the other person's time with inconsequential information. That summer, I said to myself, "Now I know why these are my people," he says. But that was China. This is Cambridge, Massachusetts. And if one judges HBS by how well it prepares students for the real world, it seems to be doing an excellent job. After all, Don Chen will graduate into a business culture in which verbal fluency and sociability are the two most important predictors of success, according to a Stanford Business School study. It's a world in which a middle manager at GE once told me that people here don't even want to meet with you if you don't have a PowerPoint and a pitch for them. Even if you're just making a recommendation to your colleague, you can't sit down in someone's office and tell them what you think. You have to make a presentation with pros and cons and a takeaway box. Unless they're self-employed or able to telecommute, many adults work in offices where they must take care to glide down the corridors, greeting their colleagues warmly and confidently. The business world says a 2006 article from the Wharton Program for Working Professionals, is filled with office environments similar to one described by an Atlanta-area corporate trainer. Here, everyone knows that it's important to be an extrovert and troublesome to be an introvert, so people work real hard at looking like extroverts, whether that's comfortable or not. It's like making sure you drink the same single malt scotch the CEO drinks and that you work out at the right health club. Even businesses that employ many artists, designers, and other imaginative types often display a preference for extroversion. "We want to attract creative people," the director of human resources at a major media company told me. When I asked what she meant by creative, she answered without missing a beat, "You have to be outgoing, fun, and jazzed up to work here." Contemporary ads aimed at business people would give the Williams Luxury Shaving Cream ads of yesteryear a run for their money. One line of TV commercials that ran on CNBC, the cable business channel, featured an office worker losing out on a plum assignment. Boss to Ted and Alice. "Ted, I'm sending Alice to the sales conference because she thinks faster on her feet than you." Ted, speechless. Boss, "So Alice, we'll send you on Thursday." Ted, "She does not." Other ads explicitly sell their products as extroversion enhancers. In 2000, Amtrak encouraged travelers to depart from your inhibitions. Nike became a prominent brand partly on the strength of its "Just Do It" campaign. And in 1999 and 2000, a series of ads for the psychotropic drug Paxil promised to cure the extreme shyness known as social anxiety disorder by offering Cinderella stories of personality transformation. One Paxil ad showed a well-dressed executive shaking hands over a business deal. "I can taste success," read the caption. Another showed what happens without the drug. A businessman, alone in his office, his forehead resting dejectedly on a clenched fist. "I should have joined in more often," it read. Yet even at Harvard Business School, there are signs that something might be wrong with a leadership style that values quick and assertive answers over quiet, slow decision-making. Every autumn, the incoming class participates in an elaborate role-playing game called the Subarctic Survival Situation. It is approximately 2:30 p.m., October 5th, the students are told, and you have just crash-landed in a float plane on the east shore of Laura Lake in the subarctic region of the northern Quebec-Newfoundland border. The students are divided into small groups and asked to imagine that their group has salvaged 15 items from the plane: a compass, sleeping bag, axe, and so on. Then they're told to rank them in order of importance to the group's survival. First, the students rank the items individually. Then they do so as a team. Next, they score those rankings against an expert's to see how well they did. Finally, they watch a videotape of their team's discussions to see what went right or wrong. The point of the exercise is to teach group synergy. Successful synergy means a higher ranking for the team than for its individual members. The group fails when any of its members has a better ranking than the overall team. And failure is exactly what can happen when students prize assertiveness too highly. One of Don's classmates was in a group lucky to include a young man with extensive experience in the northern backwoods. He had a lot of good ideas about how to rank the 15 salvaged items, but his group didn't listen because he expressed his views too quietly. "Our action plan hinged on what the most vocal people suggested," recalls the classmate. "When the less vocal people put out ideas, those ideas were discarded. The ideas that were rejected would have kept us alive and out of trouble, but they were dismissed because of the conviction with which the more vocal people suggested their ideas. Afterwards, they played us back the videotape, and it was so embarrassing." The subarctic survival situation may sound like a harmless game played inside the ivory tower, but if you think of meetings you've attended, you can probably recall a time, plenty of times, when the opinion of the most dynamic or talkative person prevailed to the detriment of all. Perhaps it was a low-stakes situation, your PTA, say, deciding whether to meet on Monday or Tuesday nights. But maybe it was important, an emergency meeting of Enron's top brass, considering whether or not to disclose questionable accounting practices. See Chapter 7 for more on Enron. Or a jury deliberating whether or not to send a single mother to jail. I discussed the subarctic survival situation with HBS Professor Quinn Mills, an expert on leadership styles. Mills is a courteous man, dressed on the day we met in a pinstriped suit and yellow polka dot tie. He has a sonorous voice and uses it skillfully. The HBS method presumes that leaders should be vocal, he told me flat out, and in my view, that's part of reality. But Mills also pointed to the common phenomenon known as the winner's curse, in which two companies bid competitively to acquire a third, until the price climbs so high that it becomes less an economic activity than a war of egos. The winning bidders will be damned if they'll let their opponents get the prize, so they buy the target company at an inflated price. It tends to be the assertive people who carry the day in these kinds of things, says Mills. You see this all the time. People ask, how did this happen? How did we pay so much? Usually it's said that they were carried away by the situation, but that's not right. Usually, they're carried away by people who are assertive and domineering. The risk with our students is that they're very good at getting their way. But that doesn't mean they're going the right way. If we assume that quiet and loud people have roughly the same number of good and bad ideas, then we should worry if the louder and more forceful people always carry the day. This would mean that an awful lot of bad ideas prevail, while good ones get squashed. Yet studies in group dynamics suggest that this is exactly what happens. We perceive talkers as smarter than quiet types, even though grade point averages and SAT and intelligence test scores reveal this perception to be inaccurate. In one experiment, in which two strangers met over the phone, those who spoke more were considered more intelligent, better looking, and more likable. We also see talkers as leaders. The more a person talks, the more other group members direct their attention to him, which means that he becomes increasingly powerful as a meeting goes on. It also helps to speak fast. We rate quick talkers as more capable and appealing than slow talkers. All of this would be fine if more talking were correlated with greater insight. But research suggests that there's no such link. In one study, groups of college students were asked to solve math problems together and then to rate one another's intelligence and judgment. The students who spoke first and most often were consistently given the highest ratings, even though their suggestions and math SAT scores were no better than those of the less talkative students. These same students were given similarly high ratings for their creativity and analytical powers during a separate exercise to develop a business strategy for a startup company. A well-known study out of UC Berkeley by organizational behavior professor Philip Tetlock found that television pundits, that is, people who earn their livings by holding forth confidently on the basis of limited information, make worse predictions about political and economic trends than they would by random chance. And the very worst prognosticators tend to be the most famous and the most confident, the very ones who would be considered natural leaders in an HBS classroom. The U.S. Army has a name for a similar phenomenon, the bus to Abilene. Any Army officer can tell you what that means. Retired Colonel Stephen J. Garris, a professor of behavioral sciences at the U.S. Army War College, told Yale Alumni Magazine in 2008, "It's about a family sitting on a porch in Texas on a hot summer day, and somebody says, 'I'm bored. Why don't we go to Abilene?' When they get to Abilene, somebody says, 'You know, I didn't really want to go.' And the next person says, 'I didn't want to go. I thought you wanted to go.' And so on. Whenever you're in an Army group and somebody says, 'I think we're all getting on the bus to Abilene here,' that is a red flag. You can stop a conversation with it. It is a very powerful artifact of our culture." The bus to Abilene anecdote reveals our tendency to follow those who initiate action, any action. We are similarly inclined to empower dynamic speakers. One highly successful venture capitalist who is regularly pitched by young entrepreneurs told me how frustrated he is by his colleagues' failure to distinguish between good presentation skills and true leadership ability. I worry that there are people who are put in positions of authority because they're good talkers, but they don't have good ideas, he said. It's so easy to confuse schmoozing ability with talent. Someone seems like a good presenter, easy to get along with, and those traits